Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
The oldest artificial object orbiting the Earth is not Sputnik. This Soviet satellite burned up a few months after it was launched. It's actually an American satellite named Vanguard 1. It might also surprise you that it was designed and built not by NASA, but by the Naval Research Laboratory. It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, I speak with Angelina Callahan about the Vanguard project. While Vanguard 1 was driven by Cold War competition, it was also a lot more than that. A scientific platform for understanding the space environment and a test vehicle for satellites to come. Callahan is the Naval Research Laboratory historian. She is the co-author of the book NASA in the World, 50 Years of International Collaboration in Space.
Angelina Callahan, thanks for talking with me today.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about Vanguard, I was wondering if you could bring us back to 1955. This is the year, as I understand it, that the Naval Research Laboratory proposes a U.S. satellite project to the U.S. government as a part of the International Geophysical Year. Why would International Geophysical Year be interested in satellites to begin with?
Well, the larger deciding mechanism behind this was the fact that the Eisenhower White House recognized the value of eventually launching reconnaissance satellites, and they made the conscious decision that it would be in the best interest, in the best strategic interest, to first launch scientific satellites to prove the value of peaceful overflight at this new altitude, that the notion that national sovereignty does not extend up into space. And so this was sort of the catalyst that unleashed the amount of money that was necessary to get this first prototype scientific satellite system off of the ground in 1955.
Uh-huh. And at this time, interest in the upper regions of the atmosphere, that had existed since before World War II. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As early as the 1920s, the U.S. Navy had been using high-frequency radio systems that were affected by the Earth's ionosphere, which means space weather. Sometimes that was useful. For instance, if you wanted radio signal to be reflected beyond the horizon, the ionosphere would reflect it back to Earth and sometimes it would travel hundreds of miles, sometimes it would even circle the Earth. So World War II and Cold War navigation systems and communication systems and methods of tracking enemy submarines relied on a sophisticated understanding of the ionosphere to operate better, both for more extensive communication, but also more secure communication.
Is it something about the project of the Navy or the conditions under which the Navy operates that would make it the most logical candidate for a satellite program? Because I think probably a lot of listeners are wondering, the Navy, really? Why are they the ones winning the, you know, winning the case to send up a satellite?
Well, that decision, the decision for NRL to be the responsible body for the United States' first scientific satellite system was actually based on a competition ostensibly among three different satellite proposals. And the first and best known satellite proposal was put forth by Wernher von Braun from the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. And his philosophy behind launching a satellite for the International Geophysical Year was get it up as quickly as possible, because he recognized the propaganda value of this, and do it as cheaply as possible so that you could prove that this was easy to achieve. And basically, little after that, he had little interest in more sophisticated tracking systems. He wasn't that concerned with engaging with the scientific communities to have various scientific payloads put on. This was his first orbiter proposal. And so that was the first proposal that was put forth for the International Geophysical Year. And what happened was the Office of Naval Research, which was one of the prime sponsors for the IGY satellite program, came to their lab, the Naval Research Lab, and they said, "What do you think of this proposal?" And the NRL researchers looked at it and they said, "Well, it's pretty viable, but basically they said you can do a whole lot more if you're going to be funding a scientific satellite for the International Geophysical Year." They came back, and due to their experience with sounding rocket research over the last 10 years, they provided a much more extensive proposal for a satellite tracking network that extended across the United States and through Central America and down into South America so that they could more precisely track satellites in all weather. And they had scientific payloads that they had experience with from sounding rockets and such.
So, you know, one of the things I find interesting about your writing on this is that I think so many of us who look at Cold War science, or just even really the Cold War era in general, tend to think of everything through that lens of, okay, there's some kind of strategic military interest in this project that's being camouflaged by whatever else it is, science or sports or something. And you make the case that, well, no, the scientific interest in the ionosphere is real, and this project was a serious attempt to get some of that work done. So if you don't mind me getting into the weeds a little bit here, a lot of us know from probably from like middle school that the ionosphere bounces radio signals, but it's more complicated than that, right? I mean, this ionosphere thing was pretty difficult to figure out, right? What made it so important, I guess, as a subject of study?
Well, in 1955, they had not yet even sorted out what natural processes created the ionosphere. It was a huge shock just to learn the full breadth of the sun's radiative output. And so there are many variables behind the ionosphere's fluctuation. It reconstitutes itself sometimes multiple times during the day, over the course of seasons, whether you're on the nighttime or the daytime side of the Earth. And then you have the 11-year solar cycle that's also impacting the way that the ionosphere can reflect radio waves. And so a lot of people will use the shorthand of talking about, you know, like reflecting radio waves, but in fact, it actually distorts radio waves. And sometimes it changes the polarity of radio waves, or it can change the amplitude of radio waves. And as radio systems are getting increasingly sophisticated, and as you have different kinds of navigation or reconnaissance or communication systems, small alterations can have a big impact on what you're doing.
Yeah, when I was reading your work on Vanguard, and I was realizing that, of course, I didn't know any of this about the ionosphere, but it almost seems like it's kind of a part of two weather systems, right? It's a part of the Earth, but it's also affected so much by solar radiation and all these other things. It seems like it would be extremely complex, and yet also, as you were pointing out, vital for radio communication, right? They did have, was it low frequency ways of communicating? What was wrong with the ways that people were communicating with radio prior to these experiments?
Actually, let me back up. I do want to add one thing. Yeah. As far as the ionosphere is concerned, this is a bleeding edge problem that the lab is dealing with to this day. And you just touched on the fact that the ionosphere, you know, because it fluctuates between being as close as, you know, 50 miles altitude from the Earth to being, you know, 700 miles altitude from the Earth. This is something that is operating on the boundary between what we perceive as weather on Earth and what we call space weather, kind of loosely. And so this is something that the lab is still working on to this day, because they need to figure out the forcing relationship on both sides, or as the ionosphere is also impacting Earth's weather.
Wow. So in 1955, NRL gets essentially approval to work on Vanguard. And then in 57, October 57, the Soviet Union launches Sputnik. What happens then? How does this change the kind of U.S. satellite program?
Vanguard is not being treated as a national priority crash program in the interest of a space race. Their concern is producing a viable system that will perform well. And when Sputnik is first launched in October of 1957, this comes as a surprise to the broader communities, but it's not a total shock to the Vanguard professionals who've been operating in this international network for quite some time. They know that the Soviets had announced that they were eventually going to launch an IGY satellite. They never gave a clear indication of when it would happen. And there was an announcement a few days before its launch saying that their launch was, I think the translation was impending or something like that. What is important is that on August 21, weeks before the launch of Sputnik, the Soviets do launch an R-7, which was the launch vehicle that was used for Sputnik in a test fire. And this does raise concern among some in the DoD communities who recognize the utility of that for launching satellites.
So Sputnik goes up, and Vanguard, which, as you were saying before, is really being developed not as a let's get their first project, but a real scientific project to study the ionosphere. Is there pressure at that point to, I don't know, get something up quick?
Absolutely. And it wasn't just about the ionosphere and solar radiation. They also had a prototype weather satellite instrument on one of the Vanguard satellites planned for them. But there is pressure for them to rush. And the first thing that happens is that there was a test vehicle planned for the first week of December in 1957. And what the lab winds up doing is they develop a miniature satellite vehicle. They call it the Grapefruit because the actual Vanguard satellite buses were about 20 inches and the Grapefruit was much smaller. It was about 8 or 9 inches in diameter. And they develop the Grapefruit and they call this a test vehicle because the original plan was just to fire all three stages of the rocket to prove that they could get the launch passed and that all three stages would work as anticipated when they really launch a satellite. And so instead, they launch a test vehicle. They try to launch a test vehicle in December. They add the Grapefruit satellite onto it, which basically only has a tracking transmitter on it. And the rest is history, right? Like, this is Flopnik. This is Kaputnik. This is the launch that goes up in flames on television for the world to see. So, of course, the Vanguard team is crushed by this, and they come under more pressure. Shortly thereafter, nationalistic concerns come into play. And it is determined that the Von Braun team will be permitted to enter into the IGY satellite portfolio. And so, they managed to get a satellite up, the first U.S. satellite up. And so when they enter into the IGY satellite.
That was, sorry to interrupt, that was Explorer 1?
Yes, Explorer 1. And so it's determined. Von Braun and his team, who've been waiting in the wings anxiously for their opportunity to prove themselves, are brought into the IGY program. And what happens is they reevaluate the launch manifest of scientific instruments that were supposed to go up on Vanguard, because these things they took years to design and test and build, and for, you know, systems integration for the whole satellite to work together. And this was all under NRL's supervision. And so then they begin working to transition hardware from what was going to be Vanguard payloads to the Explorer system, and one of the first scientists to pick up and to move shop is Van Allen. Van Allen takes his radiation belts experiment over to Explorer.
So what was the reaction of NRL scientists and policy people to the Army coming in to cannibalize their Vanguard project and stick it on an Army rocket? I mean, they couldn't have been very approving of it.
Well, you know, I've found documents from the National Academies of Sciences in which the main concern that's being voiced at this time is not so much who launches the payloads, but that the nationalistic space race powers that be recognize that implementing a crash program is not going to make this a more methodical and successful program necessarily,
yeah.
Right? Like you can unleash all the money and you can reduce the time, but you know, you've heard the famous saying about faster, better, cheaper.
Yeah.
Pick two.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so there are lots of pleas that are basically going out saying, you know, like let's keep this methodical, let's keep this practical and be thinking about the rate at which we're going. And as you know, they're under a lot of pressure to show that the US can launch, you know, like multiple successful satellites. Yes, there was something of an animosity between the two teams that dates back to the earlier days of von Braun's fantastic prognostications about spaceflight and space exploration.
Did Explorer have a lot of components from Vanguard? I mean, what could Explorer actually do?
They carried the scientific payloads that had been developed originally for Vanguard satellites. They carried their own microlock tracking transmitters, mm-hmm. the mini-track tracking network that was used to track both the Vanguard and the Sputnik satellites was also used to track the Explorers as well.
After the launch of Explorer 1, the Vanguard program doesn't go away. It seems like it continues on, right? The development of this satellite system, which is much more complicated, continues for, another couple of years?
Absolutely. They even extended the International Geophysical Year in order to accommodate more IGY satellite launches. And of course, you know, to the surprise of nobody, it takes longer than expected for them to, you know, like be reducing the data and get information to the data centers and for everything to be reported back and such. And so they extend the International Geophysical Year into 1959. And so, you know, one of the things that we're not talking about here is the formation of NASA. So Vanguard bridges these earlier ad hoc efforts that were made in space exploration in the United States that were largely driven by DOD funds because DOD researchers were the ones who had the expertise in, you know, launching and tracking and building launch vehicles, right? And they're asking these sorts of national defense questions that I had described earlier.
Yeah.
I think it's important to understand that in the days immediately after World War II, when the Army brought V-2 missiles back to the United States, basically with the intention of reverse engineering and figuring out how to build missiles of their own, they approached the Navy and they asked them what they would think about basically collaborating on launching these 60 or so V-2 missiles. And when they do, they begin discussing the possibility of, you know, if you're going to practice, if you're essentially going to practice designing and launching missiles, you might as well put a payload on it. And so this is when multiple scientific institutions, multiple armed services labs from the Army and Navy and eventually the Air Force, universities, many industrial partners partnered together in the Upper Atmosphere Research Panel, Rocket Research Panel. And through this coordinating mechanism, they determined how they would share finite resources, right? Like if you have 60 V2s, you've only got at most 60 shots. And so they decide that they're all in this together and that if they're going to glean as much as they can out of these systems, they'll figure out ways that their skill sets can complement one another or how they can reduce undue duplication of effort in, you know, the scientific questions that they're asking.
And that's NRL is doing that, or is this beyond them?
It's not run by any one federal institution. It's a voluntary group that's coordinating these mechanisms. It's accepted by the DOD as being kind of the authority of how to allocate these resources.
Yeah, that was a question I wanted to ask you, which is that, you know, the first time we talked about this a few months ago, you were saying that, like, this was unbelievably complicated to do. You're working in all of these different not only with new technologies like solar power panels, for example, which I think Vanguard is the first to use. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes.
But also just like different departments of people who have to coordinate their work. And so I was wondering if you could talk about that. Just how did all of these different units of people figure out a way to put together this unbelievably sophisticated project, which maybe we take for granted now with, you know, launching, you know, the International Space Station and things like that. But it seems like it's a pretty remarkable thing.
Some people want to hear that, you know, like the Cold War initiative or the space race drive made people work better together. But, you know, there are so many things about, you know, like DoD contracting or inter-service rivalry and things like that that are just kind of timeless issues. It's hard to talk about the ebbs and flows of those in a really broad way. But one thing that I did hope to emphasize while you and I were talking today was the fact that, you know, crucial partners in these earliest days, all the way back in the 1940s space exploration that was taking place, were these industrial partners who were there and had their own skin in the game and were participating in this research. I think that there's a lot of shorthand used today about the notion of privatizing spaceflight with a dismissive air that because, you know, before NASA, it was the DoD, and then after NASA's formation, NASA was then the driving force behind all space exploration. But I think that it's really important. There were hundreds of contractors and subcontractors contributing to Vanguard. And this speaks to what you're saying about the complexity of these systems, right? About planning things or making minor changes in one part of the system and how that affects the systems engineering of the entire thing. We have IBM computers that are placed in multiple places for tracking the satellites. And you know, at that point in time, computers were generally leased. And so they had an ongoing relationship with IBM. RCA had actually taken a lot of the initiative in producing the individual solar cells that were used on satellites. And they had been partnering with the Army Signal Corps Lab for many years, working on these solar cells that would be used in a solar system for batteries, for powering satellites. You have GE and you have Martin that are producing individual stages that are on the three-stage Vanguard launch vehicle.
Do you get the sense that these private contractors are just working on a kind of pay for fee? I don't know what there's an expression for it. I'm forgetting what it is, but essentially being subcontracted by the government. Can you build X for us? Or do you think that they had other interests in these technologies? I guess what I'm trying to get at, you know, because I'm talking now to retired engineers from Hamilton Standard up here in Connecticut, and it's very clear to me at a personal level, like, yeah, they're being told they need to design, you know, this spacesuit system, but they are so invested in it as a national project. I mean, they're really excited about it. They're coming in, you know, extra hours to work on it, and so it's very clear just talking to these individual people that there are many motivations for their work. And I was just wondering if you get any sense of that from the people who are working on Vanguard, or is that stuff even available to you? I don't even know.
Unfortunately, I don't have any sources that really speak to the notion of, you know, how passionate they were about what they were doing or how personally invested, but I can speak from, you know, like the top line, show me the money kind of way. And, you know, there were multiple firms that had a strong stake in what was going on because they were confident that eventually they would be building and selling satellite systems to the DoD and the private sector themselves. Mm-hmm. So they viewed this as a really important opportunity to be first movers in these systems. I think all of the partners in Vanguard and the Sounding Rocket work before that recognize the importance of prototyping as an opportunity to get hands-on experience with brand new systems. And they're viewed as, you know, deliberately a learning experience. This is part of the process of getting toward applications satellites eventually that followed. So from an institutional standpoint, they are truly long-term invested in this emerging space age that's coming to fruition. I talked about the Upper Atmosphere Rocket Research Panel. As soon as Vanguard is approved for the International Geophysical Year, they changed their name to the Rocket and Satellite Research Panel. And I just want to read you some of the names of the industry representatives on this. We've got Convair Corporation, Ford Research Lab. General Electric was huge in this. RAND Corporation, which I think that we would count that as a private entity. General Electric shows up more than once. And these are on the leading bodies of the rocket research panels. This isn't counting all of the work that's going into it. So these folks are sitting at the same table as the universities that are providing a lot of the principal investigators for the scientific instruments and, you know, like the Army Ballistic Research Lab, Air Force Cambridge Research Lab, and NRL. They're at the same table.
You mentioned earlier that this is really kind of in the prehistory of NASA. NASA doesn't exist yet, and so many functions were taken over by NASA. Are there ways in which Vanguard expresses its Navy history, Navy culture?
I think that the most important connection between Vanguard coming to fruition and NASA as we know it today actually can be best teased out by looking at the origins and crucial role that the Office of Naval Research plays in this time period. So mm-hmm. as you know, the Office of Naval Research emerges like at the Upper Atmosphere Rocket Research Panel, they emerge immediately after World War II during this zeitgeist of the sense that, you know, this, they just come out of the physicist war, right? The so-called physicist war. And you have all of these new technologies that have changed the face of warfare. You have radar and you have atomic weapons. And so immediately after World War II, you have the strong sense that if the country continues to invest heavily in fundamental research, however we choose to define that, which is can be tricky too, but if the country continues to invest in science, then the applications mm-hmm. will follow. Then you will stay ahead of your adversaries, right? And so the Office of Naval Research remains a key player in supporting science in the United States throughout the 1950s. NSF emerges and it takes them, you know, a couple of years to get their feet under them. And gradually they find a sort of equilibrium in spending between ONR and such. This is NRL's parent organization, the Office of Naval Research. And so uh-huh. I think the important philosophy that carries over to NASA here is this willingness of the country to scope out funding for scientific research on the understanding that sometimes the scientists may not even be able to articulate precisely which weapon systems this will improve. One of the really important things that we have lost historiographically about NASA is that NASA was actually born of that same philosophy, right? Like when they cleave NASA off. Huh. In this emerging space race that is portrayed as a missile and satellite space race, when they cleave off NASA, they're defining this mm-hmm. in the earlier days. It's less about defining it as civilian for some parties, and it's more about defining it as a place for fundamental scientific research.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so So one of the things that I spend a lot of time wallowing in my dissertation, because we all wallowed a little bit, are the more than a thousand page, multiple volume missile and satellite preparedness hearings in which LBJ is basically grandstanding the fact that, you know, like the United States is behind and that it's Eisenhower's fault and that, you know, like the parsimonious Republicans have, you know, like kept us behind in the space race. And key figures in the rocket and satellite research panel who had been working on sounding rockets and then working on the Vanguard program use their testimony as an opportunity to communicate to Congress that the formation of ARPA was a very important step for national defense and for the future of space systems, mm-hmm. but that ARPA was insufficient because what they also needed was a line of support for space science research. Mm-hmm. And ARPA was not going to solve that problem. And the funding structures at, as I point out in my dissertation, you know, the Weather Bureau, the funding structures at the NSF, the funding structures at ONR were tailored to smaller and different research programs. And NACA, of course, is one of these institutions that are taken into consideration, the Atomic Energy Commission. All of these pre-existing traditional sponsors yeah. of pre-space age research were judged basically inadequate for this new problem that was faced. And so that's where ARPA comes from. but multiple representatives from the International Geophysical Year come forward and they say, that's not enough. It's not enough to throw a whole lot of money at the advanced research project agency. You need a place that's going to do the science to back that up.
Since you were talking about Johnson and some of the things that flow out from Vanguard, I was wondering if you could talk about the legacy of the satellite. I mean, I know it's still up there, right?
It is, absolutely. It's still in, they estimate it'll be in orbit for about another 800 years, I believe.
Oh, that's awesome. just in terms of its, I guess, its influence on or application to later satellites or different kinds of scientific projects or even the way that they're organized, what do you think its legacy is?
Well, the first legacy I already touched on is the testing and engineering regimes that were developed for these systems. There were small problems. There were definitely problems with the IGY satellites, but none of the scientific instruments proper ever failed in the IGY. Mm-hmm. The weather payload that's on Vanguard 2, the camera doesn't work properly because the orbital insertion had messed up the spin on the satellite, but all of the payloads actually did work. And so when the Vanguard team is transferred over to NASA, they bring these, at this point, decades this decade of experience with them from the Sounding Rocket years, and then of course Vanguard to NASA Goddard when it gets formed. And that's one line. For NRL's purpose, they actually retained a core of talent from Vanguard. And of course, they still have, all of the memo and technical reports that come out of this and a lot of the hands-on lessons that have been learned by pulling together these space systems. And so in 1960, the Naval Research Lab launches the world's first reconnaissance satellite. And shortly thereafter, they launch a transionospheric communication satellite. And then soon thereafter that, they're working on prototype systems for the forerunner to GPS constellations. You can track these subsystems, and you can track the careers of individual people from that IGY and Sounding Rocket experience directly into these new systems. And there's more work to be done there on this labor history element, talking about the value of in-house R&D for the DoD as well. So the idea of maintaining this talent as people work through their interdisciplinary careers.
Angelina Callahan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate this. This has been a pleasure.
That's it for today. Make sure you check out Time to Eat the Dog's website and Twitter page for links to some recommended books on early space science and other exploration-related stuff. The Twitter page also has a link to Zebrot, the great band that composed our music. Please rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help make the show visible to new listeners. And if you want to recommend a guest or make a comment, always feel free to contact me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. See you next week.